Good evening. This is Paul Kelly. I'm your host on today's Speak Up Arkansas. There's a lot of information out there about health disparities among people of different races, people of different ethnic groups, people LGBT, and even the difference of inequities in the healthcare system, particularly if you're poor. And one of the things that folks feel like needs to be a part of the health delivery system is a more diverse workforce. And we're going to have a conversation about that. We'll be entertaining your calls or questions. You can call us at 501-433-0088. Or you can email us at speakupar@gmail.com. In the studio with me today are two folks who have been working long and hard on the issue of diversity and inclusion. Dr. Billy Thomas is the Vice Chancellor of Diversity and Inclusion at the Center for Diversity Affairs at the University of Arkansas for Medical Sciences. He is professor in the Department of Pediatrics and associate professor at the College of Public Health at UAMS. Dr. Thomas is board certified in pediatrics and perinatal medicine. He graduated from Arkansas State and received his degree at UAMS. And in the studio with us also is Kimberly Bland Anderson, who is Director of Outreach Programs for the Center of Diversity Affairs. Her focus is on education programs for high school and undergraduate students, and also student recruitment. I'd like to start. Thank you all both for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you, Paul.
I want to start. Why don't we start out with what is meant by diversity in the healthcare workforce? What kind of diversity do you mean?
Yeah. I think just to start things off as far as defining diversity, it's taking on different meanings as we've progressed as a society, so to speak. I think certainly we've moved beyond the idea of just racial diversity, which is still at the basis of what most of us focus on, and it's what society sees diversity as, racial and ethnic diversity, which just means that there are people from different races and different ethnic backgrounds and different cultures. But, again, as we've progressed as a society, now we really are more inclusive, and we really do look at more populations that seem to be what we call marginalized from the mainstream of society, and that includes people that are LGBTQ people. It includes people that have disabilities, and that's becoming even, people with disabilities are becoming a really large area. It probably is the largest area of marginalized people in the U.S., if you look at all the disabilities. Uh-huh. But we've become more encompassing of all these different groups. It includes religious groups and so on. So that's what we mean when we mean diversity, and how that, is part of the healthcare workforce system. It should be, because our population is made up of all these diverse groups. Uh-huh. And as a healthcare institute, which UAMS is, we have to have a healthcare workforce that can take care of all these various groups. And we are all different. Racial, ethnic, and religious groups are all different. So when you have a diverse healthcare workforce, it just means that healthcare workforce is more familiar with that population, and chances of communicating very well and actually doing a better job of taking care of those patients is there. So that's really what, in a nutshell, kind of what the healthcare workforce, what our ultimate aim is to diversify, to provide better access, better quality, equitable healthcare to a diverse population.
What are some of the what accounts for these health disparities among all these groups? How does that happen?
Yeah, I think I think the thinking now is that we can look on the whole at any population. We can say, well, there are maybe five or six things that create disparities. And we can talk, about your behavior and so on. But I think the biggest thing to remember with different populations is the biggest contributor is what we call social determinants of health. Mm-hmm. And it's out of our control, so to speak. And you mentioned in your opening statement about the idea of poverty and economic, poverty and access to health care. We can say, well, the Affordable Care Act and all these things, they provide access. They do provide access. But access is really part of our environment, so to speak. It's kind of like the determinants of our health, which includes, it includes where you live, what job you have. All these things are part of what causes the disparity. And it's certainly not any genetic or hereditary issue. Is all determined by our environment.
Yeah, social determinants. And probably like a lot of things, too, it's got a multi-generational aspect to it.
Yeah, it's very complex. I mean, you can look at, for instance, I was listening to a news story this morning about immigrants from Africa, and the first wave of immigrants from Africa as far as perinatal health and outcomes, fetal outcomes, or newborn outcomes, the babies were comparable in every aspect, weight, everything else, to the non-minority or the white population. But after the second, child even, there became discrepancies. The weight went down And all of that's due to the environment that these immigrants were placed in or that they chose to live in, mm-hmm. which includes a lot of things. And, of course, there's environmental stress. So toxicities within our environment actually do affect us, and it affects us from a generational standpoint also. So it's interesting.
Well, how much of the difference or disparity is in some way related are related because of our healthcare system as it is?
That's certainly a good question. I think if you look at the literature and you look at what people talk about as far as a percentage, accounting for a percentage of the disparities, it's not that high. Uh-huh. It's probably I don't remember numbers, but it's a small amount. More important is the idea that there's all these other things, these toxic things within our environment that results in poor health.
Well, I know that there's been criticism of the healthcare system is that it's a illness care system. It's not preventive focus. It's not holistic. Mm-hmm. And that we wait until problems happen. We go to the doctor and we know we're almost pre-diabetic because we look at the labs and they tell us, oh, you don't have anything to worry about. Come back when it's, 200 or something. Mm-hmm. So I just wonder how much that trickles down to in the kind of services that are provided by.
Well, it does. I mean, I think if we were to take a preventative approach to medicine, I guess a better preventative approach. I mean, I think in some ways we try to do that, but the system that we have is not adequate. I mean, there are medical systems within several countries that do a much, much better job, as you know, with preventative health care.
Right.
So, but yeah, it does trickle down to the point that if you don't prevent it, and then you've got even like primary screening, which is just picking up something.
Right.
So you want to be even ahead of the primary screen.
Right.
But by the time that you get to the primary screen, it's a little bit too late. So, right. You've already kind of developed a problem.
Right.
So.
and insurance doesn't cover it.
No.
Right. Okay. Well, so talk then about what is being done to improve. Tell me how you think the healthcare workforce diversity within it will impact the healthcare system.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, as I mentioned before, I think when we look at the healthcare workforce, you know, you look at who makes up that system and what are the racial, ethnic, what is the racial and ethnic makeup of that system. And for the most part, you know, it's the minorities, for instance, in physicians in the U.S. Physicians make up about, somewhere in the 3-5% range, minority physicians of all physicians in the U.S. Mm-hmm. And that's a small number. If you look at, say, for instance, like teaching hospitals, you know, minorities make up somewhere around 7-7.5% of all faculty at teaching hospitals. So what that says is that you got a minority population in the U.S. that's about 33-34% minorities. And in Arkansas, the minority population is probably 24-25%. So you can see that that's a big disparity in the number of minorities within even the healthcare system as physicians or at a medical center. So that creates, you know, that disparity so that you don't have that input or that perspective of that minority population, and it's not represented. So a lot of the health problems of minority populations are not addressed. You know, not addressed because it's a second thought, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, I mean, that translates into the number of people that you train and the number of people that are minority that go out and actually take care of people.
Uh-huh.
So,
well, and I think it's always good to have someone you can relate to who you're trying to explain personal things with and seek some support. So, that's, I know in some of the real difficult areas of the world, they do a good job of putting people who live in the local community out there trying to at least be the contact related to health. I know Paul Farmer and those folks out there have done a great amount of that. So what are some of the barriers to increasing diversity?
Mm-hmm. Well, if you just focus on healthcare, for example, and how, and you're just looking at numbers in the healthcare system. I mean, this is laying aside system issues or policy issues, but we're just looking at what can you change. I think if you look at health disparities on the whole, you got three broad places that, you know, health disparities maybe can be changed. One of them is just my individual preference as to what doctor I want. And that, you know, that's my preference. Or if I need a specialist, I got to go to a specialist. So there's not much you can do with that. The second thing is the system itself. Like when I say that, like the institution or the academic healthcare system or the hospital systems themselves and how there's institutional discrimination in some cases that may not allow the best care of minority patients. And that is hard to do. It's hard to change things within a system. And it's not just an individual hospital or academic health center. It's the U.S. system of approach to health care itself, which kind of is shown with the resistance to the Affordable Care Act. And why is it not left in place that when you've gotten a health care policy that actually takes care of or brings under that umbrella more underserved and disadvantaged and minority people? So it's hard to make those changes, as we see. It may end up, who knows what they're going to do with the Affordable Care Act. So that's one place. The other place is what we focus on. And the third place is just changing the makeup of the healthcare workforce, which we all believe will have an impact on overall not just individual patient care, but in the end, what we call population health.
Okay. Well, you're listening to Speak Up Arkansas. Our discussions are about diversity in the healthcare workforce. We've been discussing disparities in the healthcare system, but we're talking about finding solutions for that today. So, would you, if you have a question, you're welcome to call us at 501-433-0088, or you can email me at speakupar@gmail.com, and I'll pass along your questions or comments. Again, in the studio with me is Dr. Billy Thomas, Vice Chancellor of Diversity and Inclusion at the Center for Diversity Affairs at UAMS, and Kimberly Lan Anderson. Kimberly, well, specifically then, let's talk about what's being done at UAMS to increase diversity of its graduates and the challenges that go along with that.
Well, that's one of those components that Dr. Thomas was referring to, of increasing the number of underrepresented minorities to within the healthcare field, is getting those underrepresented minorities geared to train and given the necessary tools to become physicians and to come and conduct research at our institution.
Okay.
And increase those numbers of minorities and those numbers that Dr. Thomas is talking about.
Okay. And how do you do that?
We do that. We have several. We start all the way. We want to start young, and we start at the young age. We started like at 6 years old. So at 6 years old, we know everybody wants to be a ballerina. Everybody wants to be a football player. Everybody wants to be a basketball player. So with our Junior STEM Academy, we get those students at that age where we start tinkering their brains like, oh, there's another side. We want to listen to your heart. If you hurt your leg, how can we do that? So we try to get those hands-on activities and try to do hands-on activities if you're in the ER to get them more thinking of the healthcare field.
Okay.
And so by giving them those hands-on necessary tools, that persuade them of looking, oh, I think I might want to go be a nurse. I think I might want to go be a doctor. I think I might want to go be a physician assistant, you know, or I might want to go into public health. I might want to make health policy changes, you know. So we started at that young age tinkering their brains of more persuading more to the healthcare field. And then as they move on up to the 12 years old, we have a high school program. It's called Academy Pre-Health Scholars. And at that age, they're rising eighth graders all the way up to 12th grade.
Okay.
And we teach them how to take standardized tests. And by this time, students are moving up in middle school and high school and learning how to take AC testing, standardized testing. And so you know you got to have good ACT scores and try to move up within the undergrad program going into college. So we give them those necessary standardized testing tools on how to take standardized testing. Give them ACT prep for 4 weeks, and these are high school. So by this time, Paul, we are actually monitoring those students. We're keeping them in our pipeline program all the way from K, 6 years old, all the way through until they finish college, until they actually go into that healthcare field of their choice.
Now, is this something that occurs during the summertime, in the evenings?
Yes, sir.
When is it?
Our summer enrichment program occurs during the summertime, but however, we do have programs throughout the calendar year that we have, like one-day Saturdays events for high school, which is called our Health Professional Exposure Program, and this is like a one-day program on a Saturday. It gives high school students exposure to what a day of life is on campus at UAMS.
Okay. So I guess each year you have a new cohort that comes in at six,
yes,
and
sir.
Then so mm-hmm. And then these folks follow all the way. It's the hope that they will remain in there for.
Mm-hmm. And our overall arching goal is for them to, you know, always stay at UMS and practice at UMS, you know,
right.
Go into the healthcare field, go into something, whether it's medicine, whether it's nursing, whether it's pharmacy, whether it's doing research, whether it's doing public health. We want them to go steer in that right direction.
Okay. And What kind of success? How long has it been going on, and what kind of success do you have on it?
Well, you know, programs, these are, they're different now, but programs like this started back in the mid-60s, not 60, but mid-70s, 76, 75. And I'm glad you brought that up. They came about because of affirmative action, and that's the time that you saw a lot of programs like this bubble up. And across the country, they developed all these minority affairs offices. And these were federally funded programs with the idea that when you looked at the healthcare workforce in the 70s, it was probably a little bit worse than it is now, but we haven't made a lot of progress, but it was bad as far as the number of minorities. So the thinking being that, you know, you have a pool of minority students that just need a little bit of support, and that these programs were kind of used as a way to identify and a way to recruit, nurture, and actually prepare students to make that transition from undergraduate school to professional school or medical school. So programs like this have been around since the 70s, but again, they've changed, and our population has changed, and what we do is kind of basically the same, but we've added different layers to it. For instance, now, you know, we do a lot of things with students that, you know, that even encompasses things like going or teaching them about mindfulness or just things that will make them a better person. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's grown.
Mm-hmm. And how many participate every summer?
Oh, wow. We have 6 programs that's currently going on campus. So, Paul, you imagine what our campus looked like during the summer, right?
Right.
So each program different. Like from the K through 6 this year, this past summer, we had 99 students. And those are those little bitty babies all the way up to 6 years old, I mean to 12 years old. And for our high school students, we had a 24.
Okay.
And for our medical, pre-medical scholars program, we had 21. And with our summer research student program, we had 19.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And we have a PCAT also prep course that's online that students are interested in going into pharmacy. We have a prep course online, and we had a total of 4 participants who participated with that program as well.
It's not all going on simultaneously, is it?
Yes.
It is all at the same time.
And so imagine what our summer
looks
like,
weeks?
Right?
Yeah, well...
Well, the most of
I guess it's all air conditioned, so people want to come, right?
Oh, yeah. It ranges from 2 weeks all the way to 7 weeks.
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So, you know, the K through 6 is 2 weeks, and our SRI program, which is our summer research internship program, lasts 7 weeks.
And how do you go about recruiting folks for it?
Oh, wow. We recruit all over the state. Some, we are out of state recruiting. We at all 2-year and 4-year institutions recruiting undergrad and to our program and high school, not just locally, central located, but we in the rural areas as well.
Well, what about the 6-year-olds?
Oh, man. That fills up so quick. That's one of those, you know, some students, we have like a waiting list because it fills up so fast.
Well, if someone listening has a child who's interested in a health career, who would they call?
They can certainly call me at the Center for Diverse Affairs at UAMS. And my number is 501-686-7358.
All right.
And if they're listening too, Paul, they can also email us at cda@ums.edu.
Okay. So are available applicant pools low, comparable high school graduation rates for minority and disadvantaged students when compared to non-minority students, but lower college rates and much lower graduation rates, even lower rates in the STEM areas? Doesn't that, all of that, I mean, where, how does all of that play out in the consideration of dealing with this issue?
Yeah, that's our biggest problem, is that, you know, you can look at high school graduation rates, and, you know, it, in Arkansas it's probably 80-something percent for non-minority and close to 80-something percent for minority. It's fairly close. But then the gap begins to take effect when you look at how many of those students go to college. And so there's a gap, you know, between non-minority and minority students. So that right away reduces your pool of minority students that will ever get to medical school or pharmacy school. So you then, after you look at that gap as far as college going rate, then you look at, well, who finishes? Mm-hmm. And that gap widens even farther, because a lot of minority students, for various reasons that we can talk about at some point, but various reasons, they don't finish. They don't finish. Mm-hmm. And so the gap's even wider, so the pool shrinks even more. But then when you take that little pool that's gradually gone down to low numbers, and you say, well, how many of those were in the sciences and technology, and that's even smaller. So then you have to say, well, we're actually, you know, looking at a very, very small pool of students to try to attract to the healthcare industry. So that's our biggest dilemma. And just for instance, if you look in the AAMC, which is the American Association of Medical Colleges, they track all applications. If you look over probably about a 30 or 40 year time period, the number of applicants, you know, from all minority groups stays fairly steady. So, you know, we don't pick up a lot of students, you know, when we haven't in several years. So that applicant pool of those that are competitive, that are within the STEM areas, is so small, and it stays so constant that we don't have a lot to work with, so to speak. That's where these programs come in, and that's why we feel these programs are of great value. If you've got a small pool of students, then somehow you have to change the process or the pre-admissions process, where you either prepare those students differently or help them prepare to the point that they can be competitive and get into these schools. So the pool is really our biggest issue.
Right. Mm-hmm. You know, and I'm accustomed to so many people who became doctors because someone in their family were doctors.
Oh, yeah,
know other doctors, and you know, I'm sure a lot of kids, and this is why that program is important. It exposes mm-hmm. them mm-hmm. and makes it even part of their thinking pattern that it might even be something they can do. Mm-hmm. And all right. Well, we're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. You're listening to Speak Up Arkansas. We're talking about this diversity in the healthcare workforce. And please give us a call here, 501-433-0088. After the break, we'll take any of your questions. And if you've had any experience in the healthcare system, or you've got a kid who you think could make a good healthcare worker and want to know maybe what you can do to help expose them to that sort of thing, well, give us a call. We got some experts right here in the room at 501-433-0088. We'll be right back. Take a dead antenna. Welcome back to Speak Up Arkansas. We're here talking about health disparities and health in the culture and the need for health diversity in the workforce. And you can give us a call here at 501-433-0088, or you can email us at speakupar@gmail.com. Well, you are, Dr. Thomas, you all talked a lot earlier, Kim, about what you're doing to recruit people to come into the healthcare system. Mm-hmm. What do you do to help physicians who come into medical school, minority physicians, to help them transition with that?
Yeah, you know, once I think Kim talked about the idea that, you know, we recruit students. We do all these things to help students get into medical school. But that's just kind of half of the story. I mean, it's not only recruitment, but it's retention. Mm-hmm. So once you're accepted to medical school in particular, and we try to do this for all the students on campus, and we'd like to extend it to pharmacy next year, but we developed over the last 3 or 4 years a pre-orientation or pre-matriculation program. And what that program is designed to do is to ease the transition from undergraduate to medical school. And we all know, I mean, even the transition, there three sticky points in transitioning, and one's certainly from middle school to high school, and then it's from high school to college. And you can make those transitions. The transitions are hard, but transitioning from a college environment to a medical school environment is very difficult. And I say that only because, you know, we tell students this all the time, that medical school, the information or the literature in medical school is not hard. It's not a hard stuff, but the volume of the material is so large that it's amazing that you can even get through it. But yeah, you know, that's what makes it difficult. And so that part of it is pretty daunting to a lot of students, and especially if you look at minority students that are transitioning into medical school. They may not have the background in some cases, you know, where they are used to that type of volume. None of them are really used to that type of volume. But you got to have support systems, and you got to be a good time manager. You got to be well organized. And so, plus, you know, you got to feel comfortable. And I think what we try to do with these pre-matriculation programs is to allow the student to feel comfortable, so to speak, to assimilate in a comfortable level, so that if you know, you know, where to go to the library, if you know where to go to the, I guess, Student Success Center, which you can go to for tutoring and so on, if you know how to get to the center and you know how to call me if you have problems, then that makes the transition a lot easier. So it's really designed to ease the transition from college to medical school. And I think it's worked. I mean, we looked at some data from our programs the last 3 years. And all we were trying to do is to increase the number of students that would, if they had academic difficulty, to come and get help. And so if you look at the ones that actually went to the Student Success Center, the majority of those were students that participated in this pre-matriculation program. So it kind of, you know, took away that, demystified this idea of that I need to be strong and I don't need to ask for help and it's okay to get. So it does a lot of different things, but I think the main thing is we want to ease the transition and allow students to perform without feeling as if there's no help, without feeling isolated, and feeling that they're valued by the system itself. And so that's what those programs do. So a lot of students this past couple of years have taken advantage of it.
I'm going to go back to this question. Why do we have to have minority program?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if it's a good program, why isn't it for everybody? Or what are we, you know, what are we doing with that?
Well, you know, I guess, you know, Kim can probably answer some too, but I guess to answer your question, you know, just by virtue of the fact that the number of minority applicants, the number of minority people that get into these schools is so low, that we can't develop a program to function for 6 or 8 people. So just by virtue of the fact that the numbers are so low, we actually open all our programs up to anyone. Okay. They're not really saying, they're certainly not racial, not ethnic. It's students that are from like underserved or disadvantaged backgrounds, and that's how we term it. But the majority of our students in the pre-matriculation program are non-minority. Mm-hmm. You know, we had, I think last year, 30-something.
Mm-hmm.
We do small groups, so you have to kind of, you know, have a fixed number. So the majority of those students were non-minority. So a lot of majority students benefit from this, and that's the way we want to do it.
Right.
Because to your point, or to the point of saying, well, you got a low number of minority students, I personally think that we can do some things to increase the number of minority students, but we certainly won't get to, you know, population parity like we talked about with Arkansas being 24%. That's, you know, not an achievable goal right now.
Right.
So I think by having it open to every student, and by, you know, bringing all the students in and making all those students aware, and as we talked about, culturally sensitive, you know, towards why is diversity good and why should I embrace diversity? Why does it make a difference? And so there are multiple reasons for it, but we don't, the programs are open. All programs are open.
Right. Well, I think the social determinants of health are finally part of the healthcare and part of the public health discussion, and have been for a long time. I guess now they should have been, and I certainly consider that a really. But training everyone too is. About that is important.
I do have to chime in on Dr. Thomas. We accept all students, and I did have an email. I think I received it on Friday. A student emailed me and said she was interested in one of our PMSS programs, and that is our pre-medical scholars program. But she was an underrepresented minority, and she didn't have a disadvantage. Mm-hmm. And she asked me, could you direct me to another program? So my question was, let's talk, let's have a face-to-face talk, call me, let's talk, because I certainly want you to look into applying or look into our program. Like, it's not just open, you know, I know that's our mission and our target goal, but our programs are certainly open up to everyone. Mm-hmm. But, you know, who knows, she might have something that might, you know, fall short within the guidelines of our programs. But she was like, I certainly don't qualify. So she already eliminated herself. And I didn't want her to feel like she was eliminated. But I gave her the link to the program. She looked at it and she filled out the application.
Okay.
And so it's open up, and it's not in everybody, their terminology of disadvantage, you know, there's a lot of terminology for disadvantage.
Right.
You know, and we can say disadvantaged, be low socioeconomic. You can live in a rural area. You know, it just have all kinds of terms with how we define disadvantage.
Right. And we all need support, particularly to take on the challenging task of medical education. I mean, the nursing profession is a demanding one. As well. Mm. I have a nephew who just finally finished his nurse practitioner thing, or finished the test. He hadn't graduated yet, but he's celebrating. It was gruesome.
Nursing is hard.
Yeah.
You know, it's,
yeah.
Yeah. It's very hard.
Yeah.
But, you know, to Kim's comment, you know, and it's so, I think, you know, our main goal is to diversify. And so if this particular student, you know, there may be something that you can say, well, she falls short in. But more than that, you know, you want students of diverse backgrounds, because in the end, you know, you put them all in a group, and in the end, they all are better, it. So we value that in our programs, the diversity of the programs.
Well, another a listener commented, another barrier to achieving diversity in the students is diversity in the faculty at institutions where they are trained. Mm-hmm. Is there anything being done at UAMS about that?
Yeah, you know, I was just reading some stuff today, and actually we're trying to write a small grant to target minority faculty development. We have various committees in the center. Part of our mission is to increase minority faculty numbers and minority faculty development. I think the best way for me to answer it is that, you know, if you look at how do you do that, you know, when you look at minority students and then look at minority faculty, the numbers are even lower with minority faculty than they are with minority students. So, again, it's kind of like athletics. It's kind of like a recruiting game. You know, you only got a limited number of minority faculty out there. So recruitment is always very, very difficult because everybody's trying to get the same people. Mm-hmm. So we have taken the approach that we look at how do we retain students. How do we retain our students? How do we retain residents and fellows that will become minority faculty? So we think that's probably the not easiest, but probably the best way to approach it is just retaining those students that we have.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. The most efficient way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, most efficient way, because it's very difficult to recruit people. And in the end, that's really how you grow your faculty. And there are other things that we have to really talk about when you talk about minority faculty, and that has to do with, you know, how they are, I guess, nurtured is a good term to use, but how they're taken care of within their various departments.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, minority faculty sometimes, again, they experience the same types of, you know, feelings that students. I mean, there's isolation there. Sometimes you don't feel valued, don't feel like you have a voice. And so that's an experience for minority faculty. And then, you know, on top of that, if you include gender in, you know, female minority faculty, it's even a harder road.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, but those factors come into play with minority faculty, and the turnover rate becomes high because people, you know, are overloaded with committee assignments and all these other things. So minority faculty, it's hard. It's a hard road to retain. But I think that the institution can do something about retention, and they can do something about recruitment if we retain the student and the fellow, and then we make the environment, you know, certainly more comfortable, you know, for that minority faculty as far as what they want to try to do.
Okay. So there are listeners who would like to know about financial aid to cover an education at UAMS, being to be a doctor or nurse, and also if there's any debt relief for those willing to work in underserved areas. Do they have, is there any of that available here in Arkansas?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's available. I think, you know, you have to look at each college, you know, to really talk about specifics about, you know, scholarships and loans and all of that. But everyone that attends any of the professional schools, in medical school in particular, because I'm more familiar with it, there are scholarships that are offered. Although they're not huge scholarships, there are scholarships that are offered. There is the availability of loans, and there are federal loans that have low percentages. And so, yeah, if you get accepted to any of the professional schools, your financial package will be taken care of. But there are scholarships that you can or you will be provided with. There is the option of saying, well, if I commit to a rural area or going into an underserved area, then they will pay for your schooling, so to speak. But there is the payoff is you have to go back and you have to serve, I don't know, 2 or 3 years in that underserved area to provide care for people. But there is that option. There are also federal loans that will also pay for your tuition. In some cases, if you commit to academic medicine, if you stay in an academic center, so there are loans, not loans, but there's repayment for that the federal government will pay for that. But there are all kinds of ways that you can actually look at. I would say, you know, if that's part of what we can help, the center can help any student with, is to really look at options as to how you pay your loan or pay off your tuition.
Okay.
The thing I would caution, I'll pause, but the thing about it is that you shouldn't, as much as possible, factor that into making your decision about what to do. Because money is going to be there, but you make your decision as to whether or not to attend medical school or pharmacy school or any other school based on your inner desire, inner drive, and what you feel is a career option for you.
Right.
So make
right.
that decision.
How can a high school student or college student get a mentor or someone to help them know what courses to study or other experiences to help them prepare for a healthcare career?
Now, Kim might want to talk.
They can start by calling our office, and I think calling me, and we can certainly pair them up. You know, I talk to them a little bit about the field that they what direction they would like to go in, along with the parents. Certainly pairing them up with a good mentor to, you know, they can, you know, guide them throughout their high school along with their undergrad career, you know, because you want to find a mentor, a good, strong mentor, and you want to stick with that mentor, whereas just shadowing that mentor, and you know, Dr. Thomas always tells me a good recommendation always not a good recommendation, as long as they write you a recommendation, so.
Right.
But you want to find someone who actually can, you know who you are and know your what your capabilities are as a person and actually into the healthcare field. And so we certainly can guide them in that right direction. And all I have to do is just call our office at, again, my number is 501-686-7358. Or you can send us an email at cda@ums.edu.
I wonder if our listeners are aware of the many healthcare professions that are available. Could you all kind of go over that? I mean, I think there's 40,000 people on the campus every day, so there's a lot going on. But
it is, and there's a lot that's going on at UMS, and not alone just the center, because most people look at UMS as a hospital. They don't realize that the center, even the Center for Diverse Affairs, have all these enrichment programs going on. Like, where have y'all been, you know, for 4 or 5 years? But like Dr. Thomas said, these programs been going on since the 1970s. And so it's just actually getting the word out there and letting them know that these programs do exist. And we want to open our programs up, not just to Central Arkansas, to everyone in, you know, around in the rural states of Arkansas.
What about other programs? There's pharmacy, nursing, there's not physical therapy, but what are some of the programs?
And there's a College of Health Professions, and they have like 23 disciplines in this field, where all the way from EMT, where you can go and get CNA license, you can go
certified nursing assistant,
and you can go and be. They have nuclear imaging. They have radio. Imaging, and I think they have a lot of like those health profession degrees where they're like 18 months all the way up to like 27 months that a student can partake in.
Okay.
And then, you know, in pharmacy, you know, you don't have to, you have to have the prerequisites in pharmacy, but you don't have to have a 4-year degree to go into pharmacy.
Okay.
And most people didn't realize that. And then we do have a nursing program. We do have a RN to a BSN program as well.
And public health, is not hands-on necessarily, but it certainly gets you in the houses that you need to go to. And
yes,
respiratory therapy?
Respiratory therapy is falling in the category of the College of Health Professions as well.
Okay.
Yeah, and that college has, like, branch offices, too. They have, I know in Batesville, I think they also have, like, you know, a campus there on that campus also. So it's not like you have to go to UAMS. If you contact the health professions office, they can tell you whether or not they have a program that's close to you.
Right.
And I know some of the health professions programs, I think quite a few has actually moved to ULR when ULR combined with the Pulaski Tech College. You know, some of those classes have gone over to you.
So they are associate degrees, BA degrees, or both, I guess.
I think they offer both. I don't know, you know, but they offer both.
Yeah. Okay.
Yes, sir.
Okay. I forgot to bring it. I was looking through the Arkansas Times, and they had sort of a career publication, this one, and I tore off the one about the healthcare system and the expansion of it and how many jobs are available and how much it would pay. I was gonna wish I'd have had that, but they look like they pay pretty well, and you know, all of us, I'm getting older, you know, I'm sure going to the doctor a whole lot more than I did, you know, 20 years ago. So, and there's a lot of folks like me out there. So, especially if you're going to go into elderly care. But, you know, I think the other thing that's also very important that I'm sure you all think about too, or reckon, and that is the empathetic, the somebody who can. I mean, I was an Army medic. I did, you know, cleaning people up, giving people baths, doing these sorts of things really requires a personality that can relate to a person, not being afraid to touch somebody, not, you know, being sympathetic when they're in bad moods because they don't feel well. I mean, all those things are a critical aspect, I think, too. I guess if you don't have that, you can go into radiology or something where you don't have to be with people or, you know, something else. But I think that's a very, very critical thing, too.
Oh, yes, it is.
So,
yeah, it's, you know, you make that point. That's kind of, you know, what we try to make the point of when we look at the admissions process, you know, because everybody wants to use some standardized test. And I agree that there has to be some standard. You know, but I think how it's weighted is the problem I have with it, is that it's just like an ACT score and an SAT score. What does that actually say about that person? in that person's ability to do just what you described, to be empathetic and to understand or to actually communicate with patients. So the MCAT scores or PCAT scores or standardized test scores, we try to not downplay, but we include those in a broader fashion, and we talk about things that, well, this student is the first in the family to go to college, or this student worked nights, you know, to pay for his tuition, or this student, all these things that make a difference and make
right.
a different character. So.
Right. Well, I want to thank my guest tonight, Dr. Billy Thomas, with the Chancellor of Diversity and Inclusion at the Center for Diversity Affairs, also a pediatrician, a neonatal.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right, the little bitty ones. Yeah.
Yeah.
And Kim, mm-hmm. Kim, give your number out again, too, for
sure, Paul.
Wrap up the show.
Again, my number is 501-686-7358.
All right. Well, thank you all both for being here. Next week, Speak Up Arkansas will be discussing the prevention, intervention, and treatment programs that the city of Little Rock is conducting and where they are, the kind of impacts they've had. We're going to have folks who are parents of the kids who participate in there. We'll have some kids who are from these programs. But most importantly, we want to talk about how after-school and summer programs and putting kids in position similar to what you all are doing in the summer to expose them.
Mm-hmm.
I know when I was on the city board during the 4 years when we actually increased the number of those programs, the juvenile arrest rate dropped 75%, mm-hmm. and it was largely because kids mm-hmm. from 6 o'clock to 8, that's when bad things happen,
mm-hmm.
and those programs were a real success and something we'd love to talk about. It's sort of, I guess, the city's Christmas gift to Little Rock. We're going to talk about it on the right after Christmas on the 27th. Thank you again, Dr. Thomas and Kimberly, mm-hmm. For joining us tonight.
Thank you for having
us. And you all have a Merry Christmas. And listeners, thank you for checking in with us. And have a Merry Christmas. And thank you again for listening.
Thank you.
You're listening to KABF 88.3 here in Little Rock, Arkansas, the voice of the people.
This is KABF in Little Rock, 88.3, the voice of the people in Central Arkansas.